Good day to you. My name is Kim Harden, and I'll be reading the News Gazette today for Friday, July 10th, 2026. I'd like to start with the weather, so I'm going to let you know that today's going to be a high of 85, partly sunny, a chance of morning showers, and a 40% chance of afternoon storms. Southwest to west winds around 5 miles an hour. Overnight, mostly cloudy, and rain is possible. So there's a high of 86 and a low of 64. Sunset will be at 8:24. Saturday, mostly cloudy in the morning, then partly sunny, 40% chance of showers. High of 86, low of 64. Sunset 8:23. So we're starting to move in that direction, believe it or not. And Sunday, more of the same, 84 and 65, and mostly sunny. The lead story today shows a nice picture of Marcus Johnson and his 7-year-old son, Jomar Johnson, enjoying popsicles at Champaign's Hedge Park on a hot summer Tuesday afternoon. The story in Garden Hills is titled Much Improved by Luke Taylor. Multi-year neighborhood revitalization project nearing completion with ribbon cutting scheduled for updated Hedge and Garden Hills Park. This summer isn't the first chance for residents to enjoy the fruits of investments in Garden Hills, but the colorful new playground overlooking a shimmering waterfront is a striking symbol of the neighborhood's evolution. The multi-year project nears its completion with upcoming ribbon cuttings to celebrate the official opening of both Hedge Park and Garden Hills Park. Local families aren't wasting any sunny days waiting around for officials, though. It gives our kids something to do instead of just running around in the streets doing the opposite of what should be imposed, said Marcus Johnson, who brought his 7-year-old son, Jomar, out to Hedge Park to enjoy the playground. It gives them activities, from soccer to basketball, a place to take out their energy and play on the swings and all this, and a way to get everybody together to engage. Johnson said he moved to the neighborhood recently and stopped over because his son was bored and he wanted to see about engaging with the community. His method for doing so was providing popsicles out of a cooler to the other folks out at the playground on a hot day. As a volunteer with local organization DREAM, driven to reach excellence and academic achievement for males, Johnson said he wants to connect with youth and the community where he can. He's happy to see improvement in the Garden Hills area, and Jomar was certainly happy with both playground and popsicles. Even though it might have a bad reputation, things can always change if you just put your hand forward and do something first, Johnson said. If you help and step up first, then it will go further. Blair I and Mariah Hurd, likewise, brought their children out to Hedge Park despite not living in the Garden Hills neighborhood itself. I said all the kids seem to be enjoying it just from watching them try out the various playground equipment. It's a beautiful sunny day with a nice view of the water. The parks look very colorful. I figure the kids will like it, he said. While there are other parks around town for the families to enjoy, they said there aren't many like this one. It's been in the works for a while, but I'm glad they made it finally, especially in this area, because there's nothing here to do, I said. Hurd said the family had driven by a few days previously and spotted how nice the park looked, leading to deciding to pay a visit. Clearly, the park is open and available for residents to enjoy already, but Champaign Park District Director Sarah Sanquist said there will be a celebratory ribbon cutting from the city on July 27th. After that, she said, the park district will take over the control of Hedge Park. Garden Hills Park, next to Centennial High School, has also recently had a new playground installed and will have a ribbon cutting on August 13th. Assistant City Engineer Alex Nagy said that the entire Garden Hills revitalization project is set to be complete by spring of 2027. In the last 5 years, the city of Champaign has put around $2 million worth of improvements into the neighborhood, from new street lighting to work on the storm sewers to a detention basin to Hedge Park. Phase 3, the only remaining phase of the project, is well underway and includes infrastructure, piping, and street work. The remaining work expected to spill into next year, Nagy said, will be touch-ups, including landscaping and yard restoration. The bulk of the work is nearly complete. Garden Hills has been a very much needed project, and we're very pleased to have it done at this point and happy for the neighborhood, Nagy said. It's kind of a success story, I think. The fact that everybody seems happy with it as a city, we're very pleased with that. Chana Wiersma from the City of Champaign Township writes, budget strides funding both get board's approval, and process took much less time this year. It's been a little less than a year since a budget approval process turned into a lengthy back and forth between the City of Champaign Township Board and then Township Supervisor Kyle Patterson. Less than a year since an initial presentation for the fiscal year 2025-26 budget, which technically began on July 1, 2025, was delivered on August 12th that year. Less than a year since weeks of meetings filled with questions about financial details, communication between Patterson and the board, and whether the supervisor should step down. Less than a year since the budget's eventual approval on September 30th, the last possible day to meet the statutory deadline, and Patterson's resignation in November. This time around, the budget process played out very differently and within a much shorter time frame. After an initial presentation in June, the Township Board, which doubles as the Champaign City Council, voted Tuesday to approve the budget for the fiscal year that began July 1, 2026. The township and the city are now a functioning partnership, Mayor Deb Fineham told township leadership and staff. Our finance team is working with you on accomplishing the goals, not sort of taking over and doing the work for you. She added that while the two governmental entities operate separately and have their own budgets, the reality is that the people that you are serving need us to work together to find solutions, and you have to really champion that. Fineham previously expressed frustration during last year's budget talks when the town board members had to turn to Champaign Finance Director Kay Neese to get more detail about the finances at Stride's shelter than Patterson could provide. At an August 19, 2025 meeting, the mayor said that she wanted to cancel the city's contract with the township and stated that city staff should not have to act on behalf of the township when the township doesn't respond to emails, doesn't respond to calls, and doesn't do the work that is required. Patterson resigned about 3 months later, citing ongoing health issues. Charlene Murray, formerly the interim executive director at Strides, was ultimately chosen as his replacement in early 2026. Patterson's resignation came after he made payroll errors that caused several employees at Strides to receive less pay than they were owed in late October 2025. The matter was ultimately rectified with help from the city's finance department, Murray said at the time. She also stated that payroll is not easy the way that we have been doing it, unfortunately. I just want to shout out the finance team because they have been in the trenches with us working on the payroll system, Murray said at Tuesday's town board meeting. It's been a while, so we are in the transition process and we're trying to get there. We're almost there. The town board also voted Tuesday to approve an amendment to a subrecipient agreement with the City of Champaign for additional funding for the Strides Homeless Shelter, an amendment that they also approved later that night in their capacity as the City Council, along with related budget amendment. According to a report from Champaign Neighborhood Services Director Rob Kowalski, the amended agreement provides an additional $1 million for the shelter from the city's general fund. This brings the city's contribution to Strides to $7.15 million since the start of the agreement. The other $6.15 million is expected to be exhausted soon, Kowalski wrote. The total includes an initial $3.9 million in American Rescue Plan Act funds provided in 2022. The changes also include extending the duration of the agreement to June 30, 2027, though he noted this does not guarantee that the funding will last until that date. $7.1 million, including this agreement, isn't a small amount of money, acknowledged Deputy Mayor Will Kiles. But it's not just a number. It's not just the money. It's the work that has gone into making sure that we're not talking about a shelter closure. We're talking about how we continue to help people. When it comes to long-term planning, Kowalski wrote that one of the main strategies in the city's homelessness prevention blueprint is to foster a multi-jurisdictional approach to funding emergency low-barrier sheltering in the community. Recognizing that implementation of this strategy would take some time, it was further recommended in the plan that an additional $1 million be allocated to Strides so the shelter can continue operations during implementation of this strategy, he said. Shelter Program Director Carla Zarnsky wrote in a report that the shelter served a total of 162 unique individuals in May, with an average of about 66 guests nightly. When asked by Fineham what items donations would be most helpful right now, Stride's executive director, Jasmine Hernandez, said that water is essential during the heat, but staff were told in a recent heat stroke training that Gatorade is a no-go. Sunscreen and aloe are also appreciated. If they can call us at 217-403-6150, even if just as they're on their way, that little bit of heads up will work wonders for our staff, Hernandez said. If not, they can stop by and drop off donations any day of the week, ideally between 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. Turning now toward national news and international news in the Mideast conflict. Attacks escalating. U.S. claims it hit 90 targets across Iran, which retaliated with strikes on U.S. allies, including Kuwait and Qatar. The AP writes from Dubai in the United Arab Emirates, the United States launched new airstrikes against Iran early Thursday, and Tehran responded by targeting U.S.-allied Mideast countries in an exchange of fire that threatened an interim deal intended to help end the war in the Middle East. Back-and-forth attacks, including a day earlier, have repeatedly threatened the ceasefire, but Thursday's appeared bigger all around, with sirens sounding at least three times in Bahrain, home to the U.S. Navy's 5th Fleet headquarters, and missiles targeting Kuwait and Qatar. Sirens sounded Thursday afternoon in Jordan as well, where U.S. has stationed troops and aircraft. An Iranian official accused the U.S. of launching an airstrike later Thursday, targeting the area around Iran's sole nuclear power plant, and other explosions were reported elsewhere in the country during the afternoon. The strikes came hours after U.S. President Trump said recent Iranian attacks on ships in the Strait of Hormuz signaled the end of a fragile ceasefire and threatened to escalate the conflict if they didn't stop. That raised concerns that the region could tip back into a war that would engulf several countries and could halt energy shipments throughout the strait that are crucial for global economy. In Iran, the 2 days of American airstrikes have killed at least 14 people and wounded another 78, Iran's health ministry said Thursday. Most were reportedly members of the armed forces. In Kuwait, military said the falling debris wounded one person as the nation shot down 3 ballistic missiles, a cruise missile, and 10 drones. Bahrain said it shot down incoming fire without elaborating, and Jordanian government spokesman Mohammed al-Mamani said all incoming fire from Iran had been intercepted. Iranian state TV said the country's Parliamentary Revolutionary Guard fired missiles at a U.S. base in Jordan. There was no immediate word of damage in Qatar. U.S. strikes hit more targets. The U.S. military's Central Command said it hit 90 targets across Iran, releasing black-and-white footage of what appeared to be strikes on an airport runway and missile launchers. The U.S. said the strikes were intended to further degrade Iran's ability to threaten freedom of navigation in the strait, through which a fifth of the world's traded oil and natural gas passed before the war began with the U.S. and Israeli attacks on February 28th. Traffic has picked up somewhat since a tentative deal last month included opening the waterway. Maritime data company Lloyd's lists intelligence that Thursday that preliminary data showed at least 576 ships passed through the strait in June, compared to 233 in May. More than 3,100 transited the strait in June 2025. Attacks on ships and the threat of such strikes virtually halted traffic in the waterway during the conflict, making oil prices skyrocket and raising the cost of food and other basic goods far beyond the region. Iranian state media reported explosions in several locations, including Bushehr, home to Iran's nuclear power plant complex, and southern port cities. The state-run IRNA news agency quoted Ishan Janarian, a local official in Bushehr, as accusing the U.S. of striking near the plant around noon, hours after the U.S. military's Central Command said it had ended its latest round of strikes on Iran. Asked for comment on Bushehr, Central Command referred to a press release that detailed targets but made no mention of the nuclear power plant. During the war, several strikes hit the area around the plant but didn't damage it. For the first time since April, U.S. strikes also appeared to target Iranian bridges. State media reported a strike on a railway bridge in Iran's northeastern Golestan province, and the Revolutionary Guard said two bridges were attacked on the route to Mashhad, where officials planned to bury the late Ayatollah Ali Khamenei on Thursday. Trump warning. After leaving a NATO summit in Turkey, Trump posted several videos on his social media site of what he said were explosions in Iran and issued another warning to the Islamic Republic. This is in retribution for yesterday's bombing of ships by Iran. If it happens again, it will get much worse, Trump wrote Wednesday, a day after three tankers were attacked in the Strait of Hormuz. Trump said the latest back-and-forth fighting would not result in lengthy military action. Trump also renewed his past threats to hit Iran's civilian infrastructure, including electric and desalination plants, and to seize Karg Island, through which some of 90% of Iranian oil exports pass. Parliament Speaker Mohammed Baghir Kalabaf, a key negotiator in talks seeking a permanent end to the war, was defiant in a post on X on Thursday morning. America still hasn't learned that bullying and breaking promises are no longer cost-free. Let me put it plainly, if you strike, you'll get hit. Meanwhile, Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said he spoke by phone with his Saudi, Turkish, and Omani counterparts and with Pakistan's Army Chief Field Marshal Asim Munir, who has been one of the main mediators in the war. The diplomatic outreach suggested efforts may be underway to reduce tensions. In a post on Telegram, Araghchi repeated Iran's assertion that the U.S. had violated the interim peace deal reached last month. Fears war could resume. Trump fueled concerns that the war could restart by saying Wednesday that the interim agreement to pause the fighting was over. He added that he would allow negotiations to continue, but thought negotiators were wasting their time. Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Kazim Garabadi, also a top negotiator, retorted on X that Trump's remarks are not a sign of power, but admission of the failure of U.S. policy toward Iran. Negotiations to reach a final deal were due to start after the days-long funeral for Khamenei, who was killed in the war's first moments. He was laid to rest on Thursday. The talks are meant to focus on the toughest matters, including fully reopening the strait and rolling back Tehran's disputed nuclear program. And from Columbus, Ohio, the AP writes, alleged terrorist conspiracy, 8 indicted for planning to hit UFC show. 8 men were indicted on murder and terrorism conspiracy charges Thursday for their alleged roles in a thwarted drone and sniper attack on the UFC cage fighting show staged at the White House in June. The indictment returned in Ohio charges all 8 in 2 separate conspiracies, one to provide material support to terrorists and a second to commit murder on federal government territory and to murder a federal government official. According to the indictment, the plot began in May when the group began amassing money, firearms, ammunition, body armor, explosives, drones, medical equipment, communications, equipment, and others. Items. On June 10th, law enforcement officials learned about a possible threat to President Trump's UFC cage fighting show 4 days before the mixed martial arts extravaganza. The Justice Department announced federal charges against 7 people last month from across the country, including from Ohio, Missouri, Washington, Nebraska, and California. Officials said the group members harbored fringe conspiracy theories and hoped the attack would destabilize the government. Turning to the U.S. Senate race in Maine in election 2026 information, the AP writes from Portland, Maine, Plattner's withdrawal has Dems clamoring for his spot on ballot. Democrats in Maine began jockeying Thursday to become the new candidate for a pivotal U.S. Senate seat after progressive nominee Graham Plattner announced he will withdraw from the race after a sexual assault allegation. Democrats need to pick a candidate to replace Plattner on the ballot by July 27th, according to state law. Whoever is selected will have less than 4 months before facing longtime Republican Senator Susan Collins in the general election. Potential candidates have already been teasing their interest before Plattner, who denies the allegation, announced he intends to drop out. Plattner is expected to file paperwork to formally withdraw on Monday, the deadline to do so. But a growing number began formally launching their campaigns on Thursday. The Maine Democratic Party has said it will hold a nominating convention to choose the replacement. The party says the convention will involve hundreds of delegates from across the state, but how and when that'll take place remains unknown. Maine is considered a key state for control of the narrowly divided Senate, and Democrats are desperate for a candidate capable of defeating Collins, while President Trump is broadly unpopular. Governor Janet Mills, who sought the nomination during the primary campaign and suspended her campaign in late April, has not indicated if she's interested in running. These are some of the people who have shown interest in the Maine Senate race. Troy Jackson. Jackson is Maine's former state Senate president. He unsuccessfully ran to be a Democratic nominee for governor earlier this year with the backing of Plattner and U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders. Shortly after Plattner said he would quit the Senate race, Jackson launched his campaign, arguing that Mainers want a progressive fighter. Our Revolution, the organization founded by Sanders, has since said it would back Jackson, 58. Nirav Shah. Shah, former director of Maine's Center for Disease Control and Prevention, announced Thursday he was vying to be the next Democratic Senate candidate. He came in second in this year's Maine Democratic governor's primary and was seen as more of a moderate candidate compared with Jackson while running for governor. Shah held a news conference Thursday in which he encouraged Plattner supporters to join him. Dan Kleben. The co-founder of Maine Beer Company, Kleben, also confirmed his candidacy on Wednesday after Plattner's announcement. Kleben briefly entered the Senate race last year before dropping out when Governor Janet Mills announced her candidacy. Kleben, 49, endorsed Mills, who later dropped out of the Democratic primary. Shenna Bellows. Bellows is Maine's Secretary of State. She announced Thursday that she's running for the seat, saying she spent her career taking on tough fights and doing the right thing, where she served as a former civil liberties advocate and sparred with President-elect Trump over ballot access. And Jordan Wood, 36, initially attempted to run in the Maine Democratic Senate primary last year, but dropped out to run in the state's second district. He lost that race, coming in third to state auditor Matt Dunlap. He's since said he's interested in running for the Senate again and announced so on Thursday. To beat Susan Collins, we need a candidate who can provide a true contrast and run an unapologetically progressive campaign, passing Medicare for all, stopping ICE, terrorizing our streets, Wood wrote on social media on Tuesday. An AP story from Washington, D.C. about the Lincoln Memorial Reflecting Pool. Olympian pleads not guilty to damaging monument. A former Olympic canoe racer pleaded not guilty on Thursday to deliberately damaging the recently renovated Lincoln Memorial Reflecting Pool, a politically charged case that his defense attorneys and other Trump administration critics have derided as an abuse of prosecutorial power. David Hearn, who competed in three Summer Olympics, entered the plea through one of his attorneys during his initial appearance in D.C. Superior Court Hearn, 67, of Bethesda, Maryland, was indicted last Thursday on a single felony count of property destruction. Before the country's 250th independence celebrations, President Trump launched a multimillion-dollar renovation project for the reflecting pool, which was plagued by problems, including damage to its new coating. Trump, without providing evidence, has alleged the damage was caused by vandals. Hearn has said he reached inside the pool to examine the peeled sealant and let go of a chunk when he was told by a park worker to do so. He is accused of causing more than $1,000 in damage. Every American should be alarmed about this prosecution, defense attorney Norm Eisen said after the hearing. It's not a crime to touch the reflecting pool. At least three other people have been charged in the same court with misdemeanors for allegedly removing pieces of paint from the reflecting pool, according to online court records. All three pleaded not guilty during their initial court appearances Wednesday, records show. And looking now at Top of the Morning from Luke Taylor, something to get you going today. Bellying Up With. On Fridays, we'll spotlight the men and women serving up cold ones and conversation in our neck of the woods. Let us know about your favorite bartender by emailing ltaylor@news-gazette.com. Only a recent retiree from teaching in the Monticello School District, Jenna Branch, has found that some skills transfer to her newer position as a bartender at the Green Door. Bartending has been a great transition for me. As a reading interventionist and dyslexia consultant, I was a voracious reader of research, Branch said. Now I research cocktails instead. One chapter in my life ended, and a fun new one began. While she had no formal training in the role prior to starting in January, which is when the Green Door, a speakeasy-style bar in the Red House, opened, Branch said she'd spent years watching her husband Kirk mix up drinks at home. Now they both go to work at the same bar, and she enjoys when they get to do so together. When we're behind the bar together, people can usually tell right away that we're married. I think we make a good team, Branch said. She recommends the bar for its authentic speakeasy vibe with an atmosphere she said owners Todd and Rhonda Thornton have curated well. The espresso martini and coffee liqueur, which Branch describes as decadent, are both big hits, but she always loves serving drinks that convince people to enjoy gin. She says they have plenty of options with no pine needle flavor. I'm excited about an upcoming August special. Without giving too much away, I'll just say it's a creamy lemon cocktail that I'll be ordering frequently from now on, Branch said. She said that her favorite memories at the bar so far are when the team works together on developing the monthly special menu. It requires a lot of trial and error, she said, but it's a lot of fun. From On the Town, an occasional photo spotlight from an area event. Today looks at the Altruza International of Champaign-Urbana's annual brunch at the Hilton Garden Inn in Champaign. Lots of pictures of these women enjoying their brunch. Altruza International of Champaign-Urbana celebrated and raised funds at its annual brunch, style show, and basket raffle at the Hilton Garden Inn in Champaign. Altruza has been serving CU for over 75 years, including Centennial and Urbana High School food pantries and over 20 community projects with focus on children, literacy, and food security. Members and guests enjoyed fashions from Chico's and competed for donated raffle baskets. Anyone interested in donating to or joining Altruza can contact any Altruza member or send inquiries to P.O. Box 6811, Champaign, Illinois 61826, or email cu.altrusa@gmail.com. And finishing with the obituaries today, in Danville, Cecil Paul Cadell, 49, died Tuesday, July 7th at home. A celebration of life will be at noon on Saturday at Danville Roorveld Funeral Services and Cremation Crematory at 3 South Hodge Street in Tilton is handling the arrangements. Nellie Howerton of Clinton. Nellie Ruth Owens Howerton, 93, of Clinton, died Tuesday, July 7th in Pekin. Services will be 11 a.m. Monday at Calvert Funeral Home, 201 South Center Street in Clinton, with Scott Marsh officiating. Burial will be in Memorial Park Cemetery, Clinton. Visitation from 10 to 11 on Monday at the funeral home. Timothy Johnson of Danville, 41, died Saturday, July 4th. Visitation will be 11 to 1 on Saturday at Kruger Cone Pape Funeral Home and Crematory, 10 East William Street, Danville. Services at 1 o'clock on Saturday at the funeral home. Carrie Marsh of Paxton, 74, died Saturday in Proviso Township. Visitation for the military veteran will be from 10:30 until 12:30 Saturday at Cox Knapp Funeral Home, 142 West Patton Street, Paxton. Funeral services 12:30 at the funeral home. Burial at Maplewood Cemetery in Rantoul. And Norma Stevenson of Georgetown, 92, died Saturday, July 4th at home. Graveside rites for the military veteran will be at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday at Forest Park Cemetery, Georgetown. Robinson Chapel, 103 Douglas Street in Catlin, is handling the arrangements. This concludes part one for the News Gazette on Friday, July 10th, 2026. This is Kim Harden. And I will be back in just a few moments for part two.